It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The Mississippi is one of the world's major river systems in size and habitat diversity. It's also a working river, a critical commercial waterway for barge traffic. But these attributes may not be fully recognized by people who live in the watershed, and that's from a survey by the University of Missouri. As we consider the Mississippi, call in with a question. You can add your views, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Jesse Ritter is Associate Vice President for Water and Coasts at the National Wildlife Federation. Jesse, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks so much for having me.
So this survey suggesting most people feel disconnected to the Mississippi despite living in the basin, what might be causing people to feel apathetic?
Yes, great question. I thought this was such an interesting and timely survey, and it actually echoed some findings we found in our work over the past couple of years as we've been interviewing folks all throughout the Mississippi main stem states, those 10 states that touch the river. And something that the study showed and that we also heard was that there is this kind of lack of personal connection that many folks in the basin seem to have to the system. We have a couple different hypotheses for why that might be. Obviously, this system is huge and it's diverse. It actually drains 41% of the U.S. as part of the watershed and drains to the Mississippi River. 60% of Wisconsin drains to the Mississippi River. But I think one of the primary reasons we believe that folks feel so disconnected from the system is because of the incredibly altered state that the Mississippi River is in among much of its course and length. It's a highly manipulated system. And as you acknowledged at the top, it's a system that's been really important for a long time for commerce, for navigation. It's critical in terms of an economic engine for our country. And in order to facilitate that over the course of many decades, way back into the 1800s, we really started to manipulate and change the system to facilitate those uses. In so doing, we have built it up in such a way that for many folks, and this is perhaps more true downriver than it may be in Wisconsin, many folks might live near the river and yet very rarely see it. They might catch a glimpse from a bridge as they drive over it, for example, but for folks on the ground in many stretches of the system, what they're looking at day to day is a large earthen muscular levee holding that river in place, pinning it in place, and not necessarily, you know, what we think of when we think of a large dynamic river system. And I'd love to talk more about all the different ways we've altered this system, but I think that that's part of the reason maybe why people don't feel as connected. Access to the river itself in many parts of the system is very limited for residents.
So there, it seems like there's a trade-off here to be that economic engine and to really drive so much commerce on the river. That might also mean that there is less recreation or ability to feel more connected and do things on the river.
That's certainly a calculation that we have made as a nation over, you know, many, many years. So, you know, we in order to facilitate that economic opportunity that the river provides over time, we took what, you know, a large river like the Mississippi in its natural state. Rivers are dynamic. You know, they're changing course. They're moving. They have complex side channel habitats. They have a lot of dynamism in just how they move and operate. And that isn't conducive. That isn't conducive to agriculture alongside a system, that isn't conducive to settling alongside a system. So what we have functionally done and that trade-off that we made was we decided to facilitate those things that we really wanted to, kind of tame the river. And starting in the 1800s, we started to build levees. At this point, 90% of the river is levied off from its natural floodplain.
90% is levied off? Wow.
That's right. 90% is levied off. And on the upper portion of the river, the side, you know, kind of bordering western Wisconsin, the river has a series of 29 locks and dams that basically converted what was, you know, a dynamic river with lots of movement and at one point in history, rapids, into a series of kind of still water, you know, kind of ponds, a stairway essentially of ponds to facilitate navigation on that upper portion of the river. And so there it doesn't in some places look much like a river at all. And so, you know, all of these changes to the system, you know, made a lot of sense at the time, and they have started to have some unintended impacts, not only on maybe how much residents feel connected to the system or how much access they have to the system. But those decisions we've made to really tame that river, pin it in place, cut it off from its natural floodplain, are now playing out in unfavorable ways as we confront changing environmental conditions. You know, we're seeing greater swings in our rainfall. We're seeing years of heavy flooding. I know just earlier this year, there was some record flooding in upper parts of the system. And then in other years, we're having more extreme and prolonged droughts. And we have essentially severed the river's connection to the floodplain that would otherwise provide kind of like this natural absorptive capacity. That is what wetlands can really do in nature as a natural feature. They provide that capacity to store floodwaters during times of flood, and then slowly release those floodwaters in times of drought or low water to help moderate those big fluctuations in the system. So, you know, a byproduct now that we're realizing from all of these changes we've made that made a lot of sense at the time is that we have kind of restricted the river's ability itself to be a part of the climate solution that we now need.
Jesse Ritter is with us, Associate Vice President at the National Wildlife Federation, as we examine access, connection to the Mississippi River and its economic drivers. You can join in questions and comments along the way at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Jesse, for comparing here, other iconic bodies of water in the nation, the Great Lakes, the Chesapeake Bay, Delaware River watershed, how much does the federal government spend on the Mississippi compared to other bodies of water?
Oh, this is a great question, Kate. And you're hitting on something really important here, which is that we have, for many of our kind of iconic water bodies around the nation, the Great Lakes being an example that I'm sure is salient to many of your listeners, but also places like Puget Sound, the Chesapeake Bay, the Everglades, we have uniting federal programs for those systems that help to direct resources and direct federal attention and coordination around the management, resilience, and health of those iconic water bodies. The Great Lakes, for example, now, since it was initiated, the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative in 2010, over $4 billion has been spent to date to accomplish projects in our Great Lakes. And it's been, I think, wildly heralded as a success story. And one of the things that makes it so special is we have decision makers across the aisle working together year after year to support resources coming to this ecosystem. And it's made a big difference in the health of our Great Lakes. Yet here we have our mightiest river, the mighty Mississippi River, that does not benefit from any similar uniting kind of organized federal program. We certainly have some regional efforts happening along the river. For example, the Upper Mississippi River Basin Association provides an important forum for coordination among the five northern Mississippi River states. We have other efforts. We have certainly resources reaching the basin, but no uniting federal program that could really increase that level of federal investment and provide that forum for coordination and strategy. And that just seems to me like such a missed opportunity for a system as important to our country as the Mississippi. And one other quick thing I'd love to add is that, you know, we keep talking about this system as the commercial highway and the transportation corridor that it is, and there is no question of its value there. But even though it's been so immensely altered over time, it's still this ecological gem nationally. It's providing habitat for 870 species of fish and wildlife.
The flyway.
Out there, yes, the flyway for people who are duck hunters and birders. I mean, just an enormous percentage of our migratory waterfowl and birds use this system throughout the course of the year. Fish species, a quarter of all American fish species are present in the river. So it's actually really important from a fish and wildlife perspective and ecological perspective as well.
When you examine that federal coordination that isn't readily available there, and you talk about how the Mississippi courses through 10 states, I mean, it really forces those states to have to figure out how do they work with their neighbors on ensuring that the Mississippi is being cared for and the water quality is something that is acceptable.
That's right. That's spot on. And the thing about the intrinsic nature of our watersheds is that what happens in one part of the system affects the other parts of the system. And that certainly applies, looking downstream when we think about things like pollution, nutrient pollution challenges, but it occurs in both directions. There are decisions we make on the Middle River, for example, that can affect flood heights further upstream, up the river. And so the interconnected nature of the system really necessitates that kind of multi-state strategy and approach. And because of the significance of the system to the whole country, the involvement of our federal agencies and the resources and expertise they can bring to bear there as well. And we certainly have examples where this is happening already, like the Hypoxia Task Force, which works across the states to help reduce nutrient pollution. But we do not have an equivalent to the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, for example, in the Mississippi. There's been some really exciting momentum in that direction, though, and I think a growing recognition from folks in Congress and from federal decision makers that that is a real need and opportunity.
How does your organization fit into that strategy?
So we are really committed to pursuing a whole variety of approaches to improve the health of the system. We have been involved in supporting a piece of legislation called the Mississippi River Restoration and Resilience Initiative that was introduced last Congress by Congresswoman Betty McCollum, that enjoyed endorsement by over 100 organizations, throughout the main stem of the river, and generated, I think, a lot of helpful attention to this issue and this opportunity. Hasn't yet been reintroduced this Congress, but we're hopeful that that's forthcoming.
And let's pause right there with Jesse Ritter, Associate Vice President for Waters and Coasts at the National Wildlife Federation, as we examine the Mississippi River. Conversation continues ahead. Call in at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Mississippi River advocates find new ways for people to feel a deeper bond to this iconic waterway. And we learn about efforts by the National Wildlife Federation. Jesse Ritter is Associate Vice President for Water and Coasts. Be part of the discussion about the Mississippi. You can call in with a question. You can share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jesse, let's go deeper on environmental concerns. What are the greatest environmental threats to the Mississippi River Basin?
So what we're seeing today, in terms of threats to the Mississippi River Basin, we've talked a lot already about we're seeing increasingly extreme changes in weather resulting in higher rivers in some years, lower rivers in other years. Those changes in the hydrology of the system do really impact river habitats. They obviously have trickle-over effects for river communities and economies. We're also seeing a lot of concerns that have been being, addressed over many years, but still remain related to water quality challenges. There's a lot of non-source point pollution coming from this system that manifests throughout the system in water quality challenges.
What do you mean by non-source point pollution? Can you explain that?
Sure. So this is pollution that is coming in many cases from a wash of over our agricultural landscapes, coming from agriculture and cropping systems, coming from stormwater, off of our towns and communities. So not from a singular point as a discharge point, but really the byproduct of water flowing over the landscape writ large and carrying with it, contaminants. And in many cases, what we're seeing is nitrogen and phosphorus from agricultural production and fertilizer washing into our rivers.
You know, at points all along the river, there's dredging and this intensive work by the Army Corps of Engineers to keep the river traffic open, to keep those clear navigation channels. And as you mentioned, the changes in hydrology, the excessive, water or droughts. And how will this become a more difficult and costly task, all this dredging?
Sure. And so, we're going to kind of continue to see these extremes happening, right? We know that even while we work to address climate change at the global scale, a lot of these changes to the system in the near term are going to continue to manifest. And so over time, we have some choices to make. We can sort of double down on the mode of operation as usual, where that's going to require, in many cases, further reinforcing and manipulating the system, repeatedly rebuilding levees, strengthening levees, making the levees higher. It might mean more and more dredging as we have more rainfall causing more sedimentation issues in the system. It might mean other expensive and costly infrastructure projects as we try to keep things exactly the status quo as they are. But we see another path, and that is a path that looks strategically to try to incorporate natural systems and nature and natural functions into how we manage the system looking to the future. There are places and ways that we can restore river floodplain and wetlands, where we can strategically reconnect the river to its floodplain and really see immense benefits from that in terms of flood mitigation and helping to control pollution. And so looking at the system in a new way and saying we need it to continue to provide the services it is providing to our economy and to our communities, but we can manage this system for a future where we bring nature back into the equation and think about how we can incorporate nature-based solutions, as we call them, into our management of the system for a more resilient future for both people as well as for wildlife and the habitats that depend on the river.
There's the tension, of course, Jesse, and I'm sure you see it, where people who live along the Mississippi River, the damage caused by floods is certainly a local burden, a burden to households and to the communities along the river. What strategies should there be to kind of balance that, to allow the river to do its natural course, but also to prevent further damage and cost from floods?
It is such a real challenge, the way that these floods affect communities and affect local economies. So there's quite a number of things that communities can do. And it's so important that solutions are community driven. You know, folks on the ground need to understand their options and really support the different strategies and approaches. One approach that we have seen be successful in some places, including along the Missouri River, is the strategy of something we call a levee realignment or a levee setback. And this is in a scenario where you have a repeated section of levee that keeps failing, flood after flood keeps failing. It's flooding potentially communities, homes, cropland behind it, rather than just doubling down and saying, we're just gonna kind of keep trying to reinforce this levee. You can step back and say, okay, in this case, does it make more sense to compensate people for their land adjacent to that levee and actually move the levee back, set it back from the river to give the river more natural room to spread out within its floodplain? Doing that, we see actually really significantly can reduce future flood risk, and it can enable the community to kind of adapt and evolve in such a way that they don't see those repeated flood events that really negatively impact quality of life and people's pocketbooks. So that's just one example of a solution. There are a lot of pre-disaster mitigation opportunities for folks to take at the community level, looking at things that they can do to shore up their resilience. Many of those solutions can involve things like using hydrologic restoration and floodplain restoration. There's also options that folks can pursue with federal resources, things like home elevations, for example. So the toolkit is large and growing. The important thing is to look ahead and to really have communities be empowered to start thinking about these future changes that are coming and try to get out in front of them, so we're not always just responding to the next disaster.
We're talking about the Mississippi River and its future with Jesse Ritter with us, Associate Vice President at the National Wildlife Federation. You can join in with your questions and comments at any point. The number to join in is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jesse, when you examine all the contaminants, the pollution that is seen in stretches of the Mississippi, like, you know, you mentioned the bacteria, there's been mercury, PCBs. I mean, does this pollution affect the way we view the river and our connection to it?
I think it does. I think it does. I think many people in our personal interviews, and I think that this was reflected from the Missouri School of Journalism survey as well, many people, you know, view the river as a source of threats. They see the river as polluted. They see the river as the cause of flooding. And certainly that all makes perfect sense. We are trying to shift the conversation to start to think about how the river and its floodplain and surrounding environments can actually be a source of solutions and not the source of problems, as people can sometimes perceive it to be. And so certainly pollution is a continued challenge in the system. Those wetlands that I've talked about as valuable for flood protection also work to filter pollution before it actually reaches our waterways.
Could the Mississippi's waters, could they be fishable and swimmable again? What is the trajectory here? How do we repair that environmental damage? I mean, do we want it to be swimmable and fishable?
You know, I think there's a growing interest at not only among organizations like ours, but certainly among the general public to grow the connection to the system. You know, that's the other side of both of these surveys we've been talking about today. We heard from people that they want to have a different relationship with the river. They want to have the river be a place that they more regularly visit and recreate. There are already parts of the system where people are doing that. And there are really valuable recreational opportunities that we can grow. And so I am very hopeful that we can get to that future. And I think there are things working against us. There are, currently ongoing changes to the scope of our federal Clean Water Act protections, which could significantly set back our progress. I think despite all this, the important thing is that people want clean water and they want safe and beautiful spaces to recreate and for wildlife. There are many ways we can manage this system in the future to sustain the navigation industry that we so obviously need, and also to have more public connection to the system. And that's the future that we're working for at National Wildlife Federation, and one I'm really confident that we can reach.
It sounds like you are hopeful the river can really thrive into the future in many different ways.
Yes, I am very hopeful. And I think it's always going to be a system that we need to manage for multiple uses and multiple stakeholders and multiple benefits. And so that's its nature. It is such an important asset to this nation. And so we have some opportunities, I think, to do some things differently, to not double down on old approaches, and to really enjoy the river in a new way as we move into the next, 100 years of the Mississippi River on the landscape.
Let's bring in Jennifer in Southeast Minnesota. Jennifer, hi. What would you like to share?
Hey, I just tuned in to the latter part of this and really appreciate Jesse's frankness with kind of the river and what's going on with commercial navigation. And just to double down on that, what we see at the river, beyond that, there's off-site damages going on. And yes, there's a benefit to getting grain to the ports and stuff, but in the upper Mississippi River where we have the wildlife, it might be worth ceasing commercial navigation just because of these damages at the river. Off-site damages with infrastructure, hauling, increased runoff, decreased infiltration, loss of habitat. Like, it's a lot of compounded efforts.
Jennifer, thank you for calling in. Jesse, as we wrap up quickly, your thoughts there.
Oh, couldn't agree more. I think Jennifer's making a great point that these impacts aren't just, limited to kind of the main stem of the river. We look up the tributaries. We think about the compounding of manipulations to the system and of pollution over so many decades. In some places, we have a really significant hole to sort of dig out of, so to speak. So I'm so glad Jennifer raised that point. And I really hope that folks, get educated about what's happening related to the river in your communities.
Jesse, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jesse Ritter is Associate Vice President for Water and Coasts at the National Wildlife Federation. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.